On behalf of the Alliance of Cambridge Advisors, welcome to this webcast, Yikes, What Do We Do Next? Our goal is that you'll have a better understanding of economic cycles and increased confidence that functional asset allocation serves you well in this and other economic cycles. Burt Whitehead, our presenter tonight, has spent more than 30 years developing holistic financial planning concepts and strategies. I'd love to be able to list all of the honors and recognition he's received, but we only have an hour. So let me tell you that he's the founder of ACA, the author of Why Smart People Do Stupid Things with Money, and the host of a PBS special of the same name, and he's been selected by Worth Magazine as one of the top financial advisors in the country, and every year they have published their list. Burt, welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Kathy. And these are very turbulent times for investors. And in this presentation, what I'd like to do is give some context to understand, first of all, the basic economic orientation of how the system works. It's sort of like Econ 101. Second, to talk about the impact on investment strategy using functional asset allocation. And third, give a historical perspective. And finally, to give three possible outcomes. This is based on actually a question that I received when I was doing a book tour, and a fellow in the back of the room asked a very poignant question, which was, how can you assume that the stock market will always go up in the long run? And of course, we always parrot that past performance is no guarantee of future results. So just because it always has gone up, we would have to conclude that it doesn't always have to go up. And in times like this, we wonder, is it ever going to go back up? So this presentation is really designed to give an expanded answer to that question. And I did some years ago research on the economic cycles in the U.S., and this it turns into pretty much a graph that looks like this, a regular bell curve, with showing the velocity of money and how often these velocities occur. Velocity of money is actually akin to the gross domestic product. And so during most of our history, we've been in prosperity, and that's the most numerous occurrences if we go year by year. Some years, we go into inflation. And this would be, for example, certainly during the 70s, we were in an inflationary bout. Towards the end of the 90s, that was what Greenspan was concerned about. And we can always also slide off into hyperinflation. And this was true in the 70s when inflation got up to 14-15%. And then at the very extreme, there could be a monetary collapse. And this happened, for example, in Germany after the war, and people were running up and down the streets with wheelbarrows full of marks. And if you look at Zimbabwe today, that has $1 billion Zimbabwe bills that are date-stamped when they expire. This gives you an idea of what happens when you have a hyperinflation monetary collapse. On the other side, sometimes we go off into recessionary periods, and it's pretty much agreed that now, which is the end of December of 2008, that we are in pretty much of a recessionary stage at this point. And, of course, that can also slide further off into a depression, as we had in the Great Depression. And at the very extreme, if we would revert to a primitive economy where you can't write checks, you can't use credit cards, sort of like Somalia is today. And so to use sort of a microeconomic example, if you think of a little village that has 10 households, and each of the households has $100,000, but each of them keep their $100,000 under the bed. So there's a money supply of $1 million altogether in the village, But as long as each is their own independent selves and they bake their own bread and grow their own crops and fix their own tractors or whatever, there's no economic activity. There's zero transactions. However, when one person decides, she over there makes really good apple pies, I think I'll take some of my 100,000 and give it to her, and instead of making my apple pies, I'll get them from her. And then she might decide that what she'd like to do is take some of her 100,000 and buy her apples from someone who has a big apple orchard. And then that person might take some of his 100,000 and use it to buy a tractor from somebody who's been put together a tractor. And so as these economic transactions multiply and the money goes into circulation, then you can see even though the money supply is the same, the number of transactions increases, and they start increasing exponentially. The result of this is a competitive advantage. And what it means is that when this is going on, everyone becomes more productive and the whole village becomes more wealthy because each person is enabled to use his or her own unique ability and specialize in what they do best, and therefore it's much more efficient. There are three results that we can look at here. First of all, in a free market, something we don't really teach our children is that when there are, for every economic transaction, both parties on both ends of the transaction get richer. And I'm afraid we teach our children almost the opposite, because most of our children learn their economics from the game Monopoly. And if you ever played Monopoly, you may remember that the winner is the one who drives everyone else broke. And so it gives us the impression that when somebody gets richer, it's by making everybody else poor. In fact, in a true free market economy, that is not true. As the velocity of money increases and there are more and more transactions, the pie gets bigger. And so as a financial advisor, when a client hires me, obviously I'm better off having one more client, and I think that a good financial planner, we save our clients more money than we charge them, and so by hiring us, they are financially better off. And that's true of all of us. When we go to work, we get a paycheck, but our employer is better off for having us there, presumably. And so as this happens, the pie gets bigger. And if you think of our little village, as the pie gets bigger, what happens is that the other people in other villages want to move into that village because it's more prosperous. The people who live there live longer and have more babies. And so the economy keeps increasing. And the bigger the economy gets, the bigger the gross domestic product, then the higher the stock market goes because the stock market reflects the gross domestic product, the total production in that society. If this starts into motion, and it is compounding, at some point, if you only keep $1 million in the village, it will ultimately gum up the works. It will slow down the economic transactions because of float, the money being in float, and friction ends up meaning all the money isn't at work, and there's not enough money to support all the possible transactions. And so in our economy, this is where Ben Bernanke comes in, and the increased velocity of money requires that the money supply grow larger. And the way that Bernanke does this now is that he is the one who adds money to the money supply, and it's not actually, we think of the government printing more money, which isn't really actually correct. If all of us went to our bank and tried to withdraw all the money that we have, there wouldn't be enough currency to pay everybody off. As a matter of fact, it'd be maybe $1 for every million in deposits, because most money today is actually in digital form. It's not really in dollar form. There's not dollar bills to cover every single one of them. And the way that this money is created now isn't actually being printed by the government. It's actually created by banks. And the way that works is that if I had $1 million and you owned a bank and I went to your bank and put my $1 million in there, the feds require that you keep 10% as a reserve, but you can lend out the other 90%. So you'd have to keep 100,000 in your bank, but then you could lend 900,000. And the person that you lend that to goes to their bank and they put in that 900,000 and that bank has to keep 90,000 or 10% in reserve and can lend out the other 810,000. And so it continually multiplies and compounds like that. The way that the feds control this is if you're a banker, you want to be as close to your reserve as you possibly can, as close to the 10%. And inevitably, if you're running very efficiently and have 90% of your money lent out, somebody's going to make a payment late and you're going to go below your reserve. And these reserve requirements are very strict. And so if you are below your reserve requirement, you're required to then borrow that money from the Federal Reserve Bank. And the rate, when you hear that, oh, they're lowering the interest rate, the rate that they're lowering is the rate that the Federal Reserve charges banks on these overnight loans. And the reason that that works is because if they raise the interest rate, the Fed interest rate, then banks have to increase the rate that they're charging, their prime rate, in order to make money. If they lower the rate, then the banks, of course, can lower their rates, their prime rate, and that will engender more economic activity. I should mention here a very key and critical part of our money system is that money only works because we really believe it works. I can remember when I bought my first stock when I was 12 years old, Wyoming Uranium, which that was the dot-com of the 50s, and I bought it 40 shares for 25 cents each at $10 worth, and the stock went up to 30, 35, 40. I was really getting rich. This was easy money. And then all of a sudden it started going down, and it dropped down and down to 10 cents, and then I got a check in the mail from them for 40 cents, and my dad explained that was their dividend. They were paying a penny a share, so shares were 10 cents. It was a 10% dividend, and that was a very high yield. I should be really happy. But I pointed out that, I paid 25 cents a share, and now it's only worth 10 cents a share. And he says, oh, don't worry about that. That's a paper loss. Well, the stock kept going down, went down and down, down to 3 cents, 1 cent, and then finally went bankrupt. And so I went and asked my boss, Mr. Meenan, now that this is bankrupt, is this still a paper loss? And he says, sonny boy, all losses are paper losses because we don't use gold anymore. We just carry around little pieces of paper with pictures of dead white guys on them. And, in fact, that is true. The bills that we have in our pocket are just little pieces of paper that have pictures of old dead white guys. And I believe that when I go to Starbucks, I can go up and order a latte and give them one of these little pieces of paper, and they bring me a latte, and they believe they're getting paid, and I believe I'm paying them. And as long as we both believe this, the system works. Great. But the system will break down if all of a sudden people say that money isn't really worth anything. Those little pieces of paper don't mean anything. And when you read doomsday books, that's a scenario that they play out. However, there's a strong incentive for everyone to believe that this system works, and I don't expect that would change, but that's why the confidence is such an important factor and why the financial world tried to react so quickly, and the government did, when there was a freeze up in the money supply, because if you lose the confidence of people that money works, then in fact it really doesn't work. When it does work in shifting economic cycles, what we see is that when we're in prosperity, of course, everything's running right. So you can think of like the 90s. And then as the things start heating up and more economic transactions, so the velocity of money increases, then we start sliding into inflation. And you can tell that because wages start going up very quickly, it's difficult to hire people, or on the other side, easy to get a job. And as that happens, you'll see the Federal Reserve increase the money rate, the interest rate, and by doing that, they contract the money supply, and they try to then dampen inflation so that it doesn't go into hyperinflation. And you remember, of course, Greenspan, the end of the 90s, talked about irrational exuberance, and he kept raising the interest rates to contract the money supply. And finally, he did it break the back of the market in 1990, and the market started to decline. But that was followed, of course, with 9/11, which severely affected economic transactions and threw us back into a recession almost overnight. And so people started losing their jobs, and prices actually went down. A lot of companies had to lay off workers. And in response to that, immediately the Fed started lowering interest rates, having them decline to increase the money supply. And doing this with the money supply is a very finely honed tool. And so a lot of it is psychological, and it alone does not necessarily produce all of the results that the Fed would like. And so as you remember back then and even since then, they've supplemented that with actual stimulus, where they send people money from the government to stimulate spending and try to increase the velocity of money. And so when you look at these cycles, you can see a period of prosperity for stocks is in the yellow star, and that's where we were basically from 1992 to 1999. And then we went into a recession, which is a blue star. And during prosperity, certainly the best thing to own were stocks. But then when we went through an inflationary cycle in 2003 to 2006, and that, of course, is the best time to own real estate, especially if you have a fixed rate mortgage. And when we slid back into recession, the best thing to own were bonds. And that's where we are at this point in time, because we are heavily in a recession. And so clients who own treasury bonds, which are the safest thing on earth, have been noticing that while everything else, real estate and stocks, whether international or U.S., they're all dropping, their treasury bonds are increasing. Most financial advisors manage money as if there's only two categories, stocks and bonds. And one of the things about functional asset allocation is that we realize that there's the third aspect, which is real estate, and we can bring that into the equation. And certainly real estate is, for regular people, is a large part of their investments. Actually, this is getting to be a very good time to refinance a house, because interest rates and long-term rates are dropping. As of this recording, they dropped down to 4.75% for a 30-year fixed mortgage. And that is a real advantage for people, because you can lock in the rate for that mortgage for a full 30-year period. And when we run into inflationary times, then your mortgage won't go up. And if money markets end up paying 9% and you have a 30-year mortgage at 6%, you win. So deflationary times, this is where we show where you can refinance your house. And some people even take extra equity out of it to either buy bonds or supplement their stock portfolio. And even clients today who have house free and clear, one of their options is to put a mortgage on their house at 4.75%, take part of the money, put it in the stock market, which is very low, dollar cost average it in, and also buy some bonds. Then during times of prosperity, this would have been like in the 90s, when stocks are going high, functional asset allocation calls for gradually selling off the stocks to balance the portfolio and taking the proceeds and investing some of it into stocks and some of it into real estate. And the whole idea here is we don't try to time what is going to come next. When we're in prosperity, we don't know whether it's going to go into inflation. We don't know if it's going to go into deflation. But the whole concept of functional asset allocation is that each of those three categories have a specific function for real people in their lives. Bonds protects against deflation. Stocks enable people to prosper during good times. Leverage real estate protects clients from inflation. And the objective is that we respond to economic changes by keeping a portfolio balance so that no matter what happens next, and we don't pretend to know what happens next, you're always prepared for shifts in the economy. And then during times of inflation, this is actually, if you're going to trade up, this is a great time to trade up on your house. In times like this, where it's just deflationary, it's pretty risky to buy another house, and we advise clients not to do that, not to trade up until they sell their old house. There's too big a risk of ending up with two house payments. During times of inflation, it's easier to buy a new house and be able to sell your old house because generally real estate prices are increasing. And a lot of times then people take equity out of that old house, and that, if it's times of inflation, that's a great time to buy bonds because interest rates are rising and you can lock in high interest rates on your bond ladder. So in functional asset allocation, we basically have three parts to it. One of them on the extreme left-hand side are interest-earning assets, which has two functions. The only thing that protects clients against deflation, and it also assures clients dependable cash flow. The real estate section, which is the middle section, is the part in your pyramid that protects clients against inflation, particularly with leverage. If you have a mortgage, fixed-rate mortgage on your house, that's the best protection you can get against inflation. And in general, housing prices tend to rise during inflation, although that's a regional phenomenon, and some places don't necessarily rise. If I'm in Detroit, I've experienced that piece. And then finally, there's a piece that's prosperity, which is a stock market. And that is where you want to be in times of prosperity because that will grow your whole portfolio. And so the interest-earning real estate and equity section can be, I often use the example of a farmer, and the equities portion is the crops in the field. You've got some cows and wheat and corn out in the field. You want to have some diversification, but you don't want to have 20 crops. And that's the way a farmer makes his living. And that's actually the way we build a portfolio, is through the appreciation of the equities. And the farmer also has a garden, his house, barn, chickens and pigs running around, some cucumbers and tomatoes. So if the grocer raises the prices and there's inflation, the farmer can be self-sufficient, and also the farmer and his spouse or her spouse also have personal enjoyment of their home, and that's a function of real estate. And the point is that the garden isn't competing against the field for yield. And so you don't try to figure out how many tomatoes in your garden you're getting per acre and compare it to bushels of wheat that you're getting in the field, because the garden has a whole different function in your life. And the third part, of course, is the interest-earning assets, which is like a pantry. And a prudent farmer in good times takes part of the crops and makes the wheat into flour and puts it in the pantry, and takes some of the milk and makes it into cheese and puts it in the pantry, and puts some beef in the freezer. And so when there are 7 years of drought, we go into a deflationary period like we are now, your pantry is well stocked so that you can continue to support your family even when the crops are bad. And this is why clients who have their pantry stocked with U.S. strip treasuries don't feel the cash flow pinch that people feel who maybe were chasing yield and had riskier kinds of bonds or had everything in the stock market. And you can see in this diagram that the red is what protects you against deflation, and that is treasury bonds. There's a lot of different ways to protect yourself against inflation. And the green is there's a lot of ways to participate in prosperity, but there's really only one way to protect against deflation. And the other part to reemphasize is that in doing this, we're not market timing. We're not trying to figure out what's coming next. We're just keeping the portfolio balanced. And I think there are too many people in the financial industry who believe that the only way they can add value to clients is by getting a higher rate of return. And so you hear every finance or investment manager talking about how they beat the market. Well, you know, frankly, it's not, you know, like Lake Wobegon, where every child is above average. They can't all beat the market. And in fact, the index beats most of the large cap managers. And as full comprehensive financial advisors, we do advise clients on investments, but we're really only seeking to get market returns because that's really all clients really need. And to get market returns, though, your portfolio has to be able to handle deflation, inflation, as well as prosperity, and not just chase the highest yield or the next hot thing. Now we wonder, is this time different than before? It seems like this is somehow different. And so we can go through historically, and I pulled off, since we're looking at if this time is different, some covers from Time Magazine. This was from 1974, right after I started. And this is, of course, recession's greeting, so it was this time of year. And people were very concerned at that point because we were in a down market. Point out that $1,000 invested in the Dow would more than double in 10 years. In 1975, this, of course, is when Ford ended up taking over from Nixon. Nixon, as you remember, gave us wage and price controls, which didn't work. Ford took over, and the question is doctoring the economy. What do we do next? What's going to work? And those are really the same questions we're facing today. And 1979 was after Jimmy Carter took over, who decided to ration gas because of runaway inflation. And you know, it says here, the topsy-turvy economy, we need some new ideas to set it right. And that's what we're grasping for right now, is to find some new ideas. In 81 was when Reagan took over, and of course, with Volcker and using the Laffer curve, demonstrated that when you cut tax rates, you actually increase revenue. And Carter had been reluctant to raise interest rates because he was afraid it would set off a recession. Reagan went ahead and did just that, raised interest rates. And the sequence then that happens is that it does throw the economy into a recession to start with, but unemployment rises, but then that starts to taper off, inflation goes down, finally interest rates go down, and employment then rises, and there are more jobs created after a two-year cycle of that. And if you'll notice here, investing in the Dow, you would almost quadruple your money in 10 years. This is when Reagan's recession was in full swing and people were very concerned about unemployment, and probably in the next year we'll see unemployment get worse, and that's part of the cycle. By 1984, of course, everyone was concerned about the deficit. That's what they're talking about now. Investing in the Dow would mean that you would triple your investment in 10 years. And in this 1984, remember, is when we had the S&L crisis. So we had the real estate aspect of this, and the RTC was set up, which eventually sort of helped us out of that problem. And then 1987, this is the crash. Market dropped 25% in one day. Everyone was concerned about, is the market going to totally collapse? Actually, this is what, you know, it was just part of an economic cycle. It was followed in 90, and we had a recession then. And then in the Clinton era in 1992, you know, how bad can it get? But even investing then would triple your investment in 10 years. And then finally, like in 2001, this is even before 9/11, the market had dropped. We were wondering how to survive the slump. And the market still took off. It went from 10,000 and peaked it at 14,000. And so as we look through year by year, we can see that we've always been in this cycle, and we've been through recessions before, and they're all the same in some respects, and the most respect is that in every recession is in some way a little different. The one that we're in now is worldwide. It's global. It was led by real estate. And so there's some different twists to this so that, like, no one has the pat answer of how to actually manage the economy through down times, and they try a number of different things to see if those things will work. We know that the stock market will always go up in the long term, basically because 95% of all scientists and entrepreneurs who ever lived are alive today, and they're all connected by the computer. There's three options that could happen. I mean, we could have a worldwide financial collapse, you know, that we can't use our credit cards or cash checks. I think that's so remote as not even to be thinkable. Most times, the second option is to have a V-shaped recovery, where we go into a recession and then the government changes economic policies, and 2 to 5 years, we're back out of it. And that's the way most of them have been through the years. There is a third possibility, though, that's maybe a 20% possibility, I figure, and that's called the lost decade. And Japan had that in the 90s. The Nikkei dropped from 89,000 to 9,000 in 1989 and never really recovered till the end of the century and is down again. They had a huge real estate bubble, and unlike in our economy this time, Japan never went through and made the banks actually mark the real estate to market. They kept inflated values. Plus, they had the salaryman mentality, which is that once you had a job, you had it for life. So they had some societal structures that prevented their recovery. We had a 10-year lost decade from 1972 to 1982. The year I started, 1972, the Dow broke 1,000, and then it dropped and dropped and then started back up, but it didn't make it back to 1,000 until 1982. And so one of the dangers that we face is that, although eventually the economy will come back, is this a lost decade? Will this last for a long time? And so the approach that we use, using functional allocation, is to be very risk-sensitive for our clients. Certainly, we don't take bonds at this point and sell them to put them in the market because the bond is your safety net. We do investments to make sure that they're not taking extraordinary risks so that if this does tend to end up being an extended depression, our clients will survive. The worst thing to do is try to time this and say, okay, I'll just take all my money out of the market now, and I'll put on the sidelines, and when it goes back up, I'll put it back in. People do try to do this, which is why the average investor makes less than half of market returns on their investments, is because they tend to jump in and out of the market, and they jump into the market when the market's high, jump out when the market's low. And the way the thinking process goes for people now, I got to pull my money out. I can't stand this. The stock market's dropping too much. And they pull it out, and the market drops some more, and they think, oh, boy, am I glad I did that. I was so smart. And then we have a day like a month ago where the market drops 1,000 points in a day. And they go, oh, my gosh, it started to turn around. I got to put my money back in. They put it back in. And then, of course, over the next 4 days, it drops 1,500 points. And they go, oh, gosh, I got whipsawed. I got to take my money back out. And then they always are watching the market, wondering when they should jump in or when they should jump out. And it ends up that this actually money ruins their life, because they are so obsessed about whether the market's going up or down. And going through a cycle, and I've seen this happen time and again, people end up freezing up. They keep their money out of the market. And then when there is in prosperity, they're wondering, now what should I do now? I don't know what to do now. And they've ruined their life. they had let money ruin their life because they've obsessed about it for so long. And so this gives you an idea of how the economy works, how functional asset allocation is designed to respond to economic changes, and how it has worked in the past, and finally, the things that could happen in the future. And, you know, we sell sleep, and so your advisor is handling this for you, so you don't have to lose sleep, and you can know that we are modifying your portfolio as economics change in response to that, and we're not market timing it.
Thank you, Bert. That was great. A lot of good information. We're going to move now into the question and answer portion of this presentation. We've got several ACA members who are going to join us for this part of the presentation, including Chip Simon from Taconic Advisors in Poughkeepsie, New York, Penny Marchand from Cambridge Financial Group in Tucson, Arizona, Jonathan Heller from KEG Financial Advisors in Newtown, Pennsylvania, and Rob Schwanier from Plans to Prosper LLC in Wexford, Pennsylvania. But I'd like to welcome you here and move into the question and answer portion. Our first question of the evening is related to actually what Bert was just talking about in timing the market. And Rob, I'm going to direct this question to you. And this is related to timing the market. If you leave your money in the market now, lose half of it, and it takes 10 years for the market to recover, aren't you just spending 10 years getting back to where you started out? Why are you not better off pulling out of the market and then going back in when things are less volatile?
That's a good question, and there's a lot of people who are thinking exactly that way, unfortunately, now. And, you know, arithmetically, I suppose that the questioner is correct. If you stay in the market, lose half of it, and it takes 10 years for it to recover, yeah, you would be spending 10 years getting back to where you started out. But what we don't know are a number of things. Number one, we don't know when the market would recover. We don't know whether it would take 10 years for it to recover. And that's a very key piece of information that's missing. And incidentally, no matter how many talking heads you might see on the financial news channels and so on television, they don't know either what the future is going to hold. So it's very critical to understand what we don't know. You know, what if the market recovers in a year or 2 years, let's say, and you're on a track assuming it could be a five-year downturn or a decade that is lost, as Bert was referring to. If you're sitting on the sidelines, then you miss that opportunity for the rebound. The point is, we don't know when the rebound is going to occur or how rapidly it will occur. What we do know is that market timing does not work. We know that people are regularly ineffective and spectacularly ineffective at guessing when the market is going to turn, whether you're a so-called expert or a do-it-yourselfer. There was a study that was done a few years ago that tracked how people perform in terms of their investments, their stock investments, when they're trying to do market timing. And Bert alluded to it a few minutes ago, but basically in a period when the S&P grew by about 12%, people who were trying to do market timing, only their portfolio only gained by 2%. So they lost the vast majority of the market recoveries during that time period. What is good, though, is diversification, not only the real estate, but also the bond part of the portfolio and the stock part of the portfolio. If you have a nice diversified portfolio, you're going to be able to weather the storms during the downturns, and you're going to be well positioned for when the recovery occurs. I'm looking at some history since the early 70s, since 1973, so over a 35-year historical period with a diversified portfolio. Typically, even under the worst periods of time, with a properly diversified portfolio of bonds and stocks, there is no negative returns after 4 years. So if you have a diversified portfolio, you should be able to weather the storm. We can't predict what the future is going to bring, but the allocation should be properly associated with your investment horizon and your goals. But getting out of the market and trying to guess what the future holds is not the way to go.
Thank you. Next question. And Chip, I'm going to ask you to respond to this one.
All right.
Last year, our advisor calculated that we should be able to semi-retire in 10 years based on the investment plan we'd laid out. Given the current economic situation, is there any way to make an educated guess if that goal is still in sight?
Sure. And I think that this is a perfect example of why financial planning and comprehensive financial planning is an ongoing process rather than an event. A written plan can often be obsolete as soon as the ink dries. And so maintaining it and adapting yourself to circumstances is always very, very important. It's the maintenance of the plan and reevaluation of the plan that's really important as you move forward. And in this case, I think I'd have the listeners understand that an investment plan is a result of a lot of discussion and information that helps build that plan. And some things that a couple could talk about with their financial advisor, are things that you can control. It's wondering less about, golly, should we change the mixture of our stocks and bonds and see if we can make up for lost time at some point, rather than thinking about things that are evident in your lives. For example, are you willing to do things like alter your spending patterns in order to help hit your goal? Might you be working longer? Might you be trying to save more than you had anticipated in your plan? Maybe there are other circumstances in your life that have happened since then. Maybe you had planned that your kids were going to be attending a private college, and now it turns out they're going to be a state university that's going to be providing some more funds that don't have to be targeted to education. You might even be defining what you mean by semi-retirement in 10 years. Maybe you thought it was going to be working half-time. Well, maybe there's an opportunity to step into that and stage it over time. Maybe you work three-quarters time for a while before moving into half-time. So, again, these are a lot of factors and discussions that you can talk about and control and make decisions about in order to hit the goal, and these can have an effect on the investment plan. But, again, I'd point out that investment plan is a result of a lot of other discussions and probably a lot more important discussions that need to take place for you to help attain the goal that you have in sight.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Bert, you talked quite a few times during your presentation about strip treasuries. We had a question of, is this a good time to buy strip treasuries given low yields?
Well, the treasuries right now are very low yields as of this conversation. Even the 30-year treasury is somewhere between 2.5% and 3%. But every time since I've been doing this over 20 years that I suggest that clients buy treasuries, the treasuries are always too low. When treasuries were paying 7%, money markets were paying 8%, and people couldn't imagine tying up their money for 20 years at a mere 7%. When it was 5%, which is really only about 7 years ago, money markets were at 6%. Then people said, why should I put my money away for 15 years when I can get it that much more in the money market rate? The reason and the function of treasuries are to not to chase yield, but to just guarantee that the principal is there when you need it. And generally, the advantage is to buy them over time. So when we have a client who's starting in their 40s, and we buy some through their 40s, through their 50s, into their 60s, they dollar cost averaged into interest rates. Otherwise, if you try to make a bet that, well, I'm going to hold off because interest rates are going up, if we end up with a lost decade, you might find that interest rates sink to like 1.5% and maybe stay there for 10 years. And so we don't try to guess that because the risk is too great, and we would rather, safety trumps yield. And when it comes to the bond ladder, we want to make sure that the money is safe, and I'm not as worried about the yield because the yield always reflects the risk.
Thank you. We had a couple questions regarding retirement plans, and Penny, I think I'm going to address these to you. Two questions. One is, should I keep contributing to my retirement plan at work?
Great. The first one, should I keep contributing to my retirement plan at work? Absolutely. this is the greatest time to be contributing to a 401k. It is not the time to stop contributing. There couldn't be a better time, and for many reasons. One is people who've got money typically save 10% of their income, at least. That's just a fundamental of fiscal fitness, as Bert would say. And saving 10% in your 401k is a really easy way to do it. It comes out of your paycheck, and you don't have a chance to spend it. So it's a great way to start saving. And in a real emergency, you can even access it. So it's there. Another great thing about contributing to a retirement plan is your dollar cost averaging. And what that means in English is you're putting money in at a regular interval so that you buy more shares when prices are low and less shares when prices are high. And just by contributing on a regular basis, whether it be every week, every other week, you're buying at different prices, so you've automatically mitigated your investment risk over a long period of time. Another great reason for contributing is that a company often matches what you're contributing. So if you put in $5,000 and they put in $5,000, you just made 100% on your money. Where can you get a deal like that? So absolutely, if your company matches, you should be contributing minimally up to their match. And then tax benefit. You can never underestimate tax deferral. If you, say, are in the 28% tax bracket and you're 4% or 5% state tax, so you are in a 33% combined tax bracket, and you contribute $3,000 to your 401k, you're going to save $1,000 in taxes. So the government is also helping you fund your 401k. I mean, it's just the best deal ever. And now stocks on sale. You can buy a U.S. stock on sale for, what, about 36% off, international about 42% off. If somebody told you you could buy a car for 40% off, you'd probably be jumping at it. So, yes, now is a great time to be contributing to your retirement plan. And second, the young professional just out of school, ready to save for retirement. What an exciting time. You're in a big transitional time. You're starting to actually make a paycheck now. You probably don't have a lot in an investment portfolio, so you're building the foundation. You're just beginning. So my suggestion is, as far as typically when people are young, they want to invest stocks and buy gold and pork bellies and being real aggressive stuff, but really what you need to do first is build a foundation. You need, say, 75%, 60 to 75% of your investment should be in interest earning, which sounds horribly boring, I know, but it helps build an emergency fund. It helps build a foundation that should be in long-term bonds, short-term bonds, different maturities. And then the other 25% should be in equities, small cap stocks, international, large cap. I like mutual funds because you get more exposure, maybe a good index. And then as your investments start accumulating and they're at least valued as much as your paycheck, so you make $100,000 a year and your investments are worth $100,000, start diversifying and maybe shift to a 50% interest earning and 50% equities. And then, again, as your portfolio increases and you really start accumulating money, you're starting to save, then you can maybe shift to 60% in equities. But the nice thing with the bond piece, and I find more resistance to that than the equities, is that it does, well, certainly we're seeing it now, it gives you somewhat of an anchor, and it helps you keep that foundation solid. And as far as different vehicles, you know, there's index funds, there's well-managed funds. I do believe, particularly starting out before you have too much money, that you get a lot better exposure investing in mutual funds or indexes or exchange-traded funds. You get a broad exposure, and you're not so pigeonholed to one stock where you take a lot more risk.
Here's, I think, another good question. And, John, I'm going to direct this one to you.
Okay.
We continue to hear bad news nearly every day. Recently, it was that we lost the most jobs since 1974. Are things really that bad, and are we getting the whole story?
Well, first of all, I don't believe that we are always getting the whole story. There's no doubt that this is one of the worst economies that we've seen in years. No doubt about that, and certainly don't want to sugarcoat that. But as I get my daily dose of financial news, whether it's from CNBC or on the radio or the evening news, sometimes I'm very skeptical about what I hear. And there was a great example recently, a couple weeks ago, when the jobless figures came out, and we were told that non-farm payroll numbers, which is a great indicator of the employment situation in this country, that number had fallen 533,000 jobs versus a consensus that was in the neighborhood of 335,000. So that was a big surprise, and it was a negative surprise. And it was held out all day, wherever you turned, every media venue, as the worst that we'd seen since 1974. We hadn't seen that many job losses since 74. And that sounded pretty dire, and it got me thinking, and so I started to do a little digging, as some other advisors did as well, and what we found out was, yes, indeed, that was the worst in 74 in terms of number of jobs, but if you think about it, there were tens of millions fewer jobs in 1974 than there are now. So in terms of job losses per total jobs, this number turned out to be the 41st most negative non-farm payroll report that we've had since they've been measuring that, not number one or two or three the way you would have thought by the way the commentators were portraying it. So we're in a negative news cycle, and it's kind of along the lines of an oscillation between greed and fear. You know, during the tech bubble in 99-2000, all news was good news, and it was perpetuated by greed. Now it's all fear. All news is bad news, and I think we need to dig a little bit deeper into what's being said, realize that not all the commentators have the story straight, and you know, talk to your advisor. If you hear something and you want a little bit different read on it, or if you want some acknowledgement that it is indeed a correct interpretation, I would say talk to your advisor.
Good advice. Next question. And this I'm going to throw out to anybody to give a response to. The question is, my portfolio is worth about what it was 10 years ago. I'm paying a financial advisor, but I don't feel like I'm getting anywhere. Why should I continue paying?
Well, if you're the client that's calling and you're saying, I'm going to sell my house, I'm going to leave my job, I'm going to sell all my stuff and move up to the mountains, it's really nice to have a financial advisor kind of walk you through it, talk you down, and also to provide objectivity, to look at the perspective that Bert shared in terms of historical, to understand maybe what's happening in your life and help you, direct you there. Sometimes we're too close to our lives. I think a financial advisor helps you keep the emotion out of it, but just kind of help keep you on track. And, you know, really I think the question, if kind of wonder, well, maybe the portfolio would even be worse than it was, but it's helping you keep true to your goals.
This is Rob. Just the you know, the opening sentence says a lot, because really the focus being on the portfolio, that is, the media, or at least the marketing by a lot of the financial services companies out there, focus overly too much, I believe, on the portfolio side of things, where the portfolio is the beginning and end of all. And this question kind of is one of the outcomes of that kind of thinking. The portfolio is really just one part of the total financial plan and the total financial picture. There are a series of judgments and decisions that we, not just advisors, but the clients, of course, need to make on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis that can influence the final outcome of our finances. And, you know, I and all the other advisors help our clients to make good financial decisions, good, rational, appropriate financial decisions for their point in life, for their goals, on a daily, weekly, or yearly basis. It's those small decisions done well and done consistently that really make the difference.
Bert, maybe you can handle this one. This is from somebody. They were recently advised to sell stock funds, lock in thousands of dollars in losses, buy other stock funds, and write off the losses to offset other capital gains. Why would they want to lock in losses when you say the market over the long haul will recover anyway?
Kathy, the strategy you talk about is actually a tax strategy, not really an investment strategy. It's investment neutral, since when we sell the stocks to harvest the losses, we buy directly into other similar but not identical stocks so that we keep the portfolio with the same weighting, and it will recover as fast with the stocks that we put in it than the stocks that were sold. The advantage is by harvesting these tax losses is that when there are capital, other capital gains arise, for example, somebody sells a vacation home or a rental, or perhaps they're gifted stock that has a large capital gain that they want to sell, or maybe they sell their company or some company stock. These all produce very large capital gains, and by having this accumulated pile of losses which carry forward, you're able to use those against other capital gains that are, that arise. Capital losses can be used each year to offset any capital gains, plus you're able to write off $3,000 against ordinary income, and the balance carries forward basically indefinitely. And so it's an opportunity, kind of one of the silver linings or a great cloud of these times, is to be able to harvest these losses and then have them to use when to avoid other long-term gains.
I had one more question here, and again, I think I'm going to kind of throw this open to everyone, because a lot of people are dealing with this right now. There are layoffs happening in my industry nearly every day. What can I do to get ready for a possible job loss?
I think there's several steps you can do to be proactive before it happens. One thing I've seen that is helpful is to start looking for a job already. Sometimes people wait until they, you know, get handed the pink slip and then they start looking for a job. You should already be looking for a job and possibly even maybe start working part-time somewhere. Another thing is to pay off your consumer debt. That's real important. Any kind of credit card debt or anything like that needs to be paid off, a car loan, something like that. Postpone any upcoming expenses. Now's probably not the time to remodel the bathroom or, you know, fix the landscaping outside. You just want to postpone those expenses. I had a client who lost, the wife lost her job, and she was the primary breadwinner of the family, and obviously they needed to cut expenses, but what they did is rather than cut expenses in a way that made them feel deprived, they've actually really learned from this and enhanced their life in that instead of giving Christmas gifts this year, the son is making CDs for everyone and the daughter is making body oil and the wife is sewing some stuff and the husband's making little leather gifts, and they've enjoyed it. Instead of going out to eat all the time, they're going on the internet and finding recipes, and they're each taking turns cooking it. So the family is getting to play together in that way. So it's important that you live below your means and that you replace some of your habits with lower cost habits. And it can be fun. Make it fun. I think it's important that we look at our expenses and we see, you know, do we need the premium TV channel? Do we need the latest clothes? Maybe we could get our hair cut somewhere cheaper. And And what I've advised clients is kind of to do a level one and a level two of that. What's level one? You know, that maybe I don't need Blockbuster. Level two, maybe you're getting rid of your housekeeper, or it's starting to really hurt at level two. You're really tightening. But just how look at life worst-case scenario. Another good thing to do is to get a line of credit while you still can. As long as you have a job, you can have a line of credit. Hopefully you won't have to use it. But if you need money from the banks, they won't give it to you. So what you want to do is you want to get the line of credit in place while you don't need it. Downsize your house. I realize it's not a good time to be selling a home, but in some cases, if it's really going to be serious and you're not going to be able to make your mortgage payment, it might be an idea to downsize that house and sell it while you still can. Another more radical idea I've had to do this with a client is to, rather than contributing fully to their 401k at work, they started taking that money and they automatically put it in a high interest earning account at Ing. And then now it is here toward the end of the year. It turns out they're not going to be laid off, so we are basically going to give him that money that he set aside, and that'll be his paycheck. And then these last paychecks in December, he'll backload his 401k. In other words, he'll still contribute. He'll just do it all in December, but at least we had that money set aside for a real emergency. So those are some steps that I've used to help people kind of get through that possibility.
This is Chip and Penny. Those are some great thoughts. This is one of those examples where I can use other parts of my life to help contribute to client needs and client circumstances, because I used to be in the personal recruitment agency for a professional recruiting firm. I will ask clients to submit resumes to me. I will help spruce that up, spruce up the wording, tighten it up so it's not too wordy. Teach them that that is a calling card. Teach them not to be in denial about a job hunt. And that a term that I remember from those days, I was advised when you're looking for a job, four sails to the wind. Basically, don't sit down, don't be reactive. This is the time to be proactive, build up relationships, establish and reconnect with people that you might be calling upon that could help you network and find new positions as well. You know, time to keep skills real sharp, certifications up to date, and things like that as well. So it's the marketing aspects of well to have people start thinking about those.
I think this has been tremendous information. I greatly appreciate everyone's participation. Bert, Chip, Penny, John, and Rob, thank you all. And we hope that all of our listeners and viewers have found this time well spent. You're leaving here with ideas on how a financial advisor, especially an ACA member, can help you achieve your goals. On behalf of the Alliance of Cambridge Advisors, thank you and night.